In the annals of unforeseen consequences, an astute writer and historian has taken a case of organized child abuse that captivated the nation back in the 1980s and shown how it grew out of a vast series of changes in the U.S. involving the economy, families, and child care. In 1983, teachers at the McMartin Preschool in Southern California were accused of sexually abusing young students. After the police sent a letter to 200 families asking parents to talk to their kids about possible abuse, what came back looked like a horror show going on in a tranquil suburb of L.A.
What happens then is the parents start to talk to their kids, and then they start to talk to each other, and then they start to compare notes, and pretty soon emotionally involved parents are engaging and leading in suggestive questioning of their child.
FBI agent Kenneth Lanning consulted on the McMartin case back in the 1980s. The allegations produced a court case that inspired other daycare abuse scandals across the country. But in the end, it was all the product of children's imagination, bad questioning techniques by professionals, and something deeper. Richard Beck, editor at N Plus One and author of We Believe the Children, A Moral Panic in the 1980s, says this was a mass hysteria that grew out of collective fears and guilt over the growing use of daycare and from the use of sloppy psychology to explain a complicated social transformation taking place at the end of the 20th century.
The allegations came almost entirely out of interviews that social workers and therapists conducted with the children who had attended the preschool. And these interviews, if you look at the transcript, it's clear that they were unintentionally conducted in a very coercive way, such that children would start off their interviews, you know, and these are young kids, like 4, 5, and 6, would start off saying, "No, nothing happened to me at daycare. The teachers are fine." And it gradually became clear to the kids that that wasn't the kind of answer that the therapists were looking for. And eventually, realizing that the interview's not going to end until they start providing those kinds of answers, they began to make things up. So when you got into a courtroom, We Believe the Children became a real mantra for prosecutors and for parents, because that was the whole substance of the case, was the testimony that they claimed had come spontaneously from these kids.
At the time in the 1980s, the intuitive feel for what was going on at the McMartin case and the McMartin preschool was that, why would kids lie about something like this? Why would kids make up something like this so it must be true? But in fact, there were perfectly good reasons why kids would make up things like this, and you've described some of them already. In fact, what was intuitively believed to be evidence that condemned the McMartin preschool suddenly became a psychological phenomenon that absolutely exonerated them.
The detection of child sexual abuse in daycare centers, the idea that this was a social problem we had to deal with, that was very new. So there weren't a lot of protocols in place, safeguards for conducting forensic interviews with these kids. In L.A., there was a guy working named Roland Summit who published a paper called The Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome, which was a description of how he thought kids dealt with the after effects of being sexually abused. And one of the things he said was that children will be very reluctant to reveal what's happened to them, so that you have to press them pretty hard. And then at the end of that process, after they've revealed what's happened, if they maybe go back and try to say, wait, I maybe didn't tell the entire truth, that may not be entirely what happened, if they try to retract those allegations, the idea was that that should also be taken as further confirmation that they had, in fact, been sexually abused.
How did the issue of Satanism and the idea that this was actually some deeper cult get into the entire trial and this sort of national hysteria?
Well, Satanism was kind of an ambient cultural fear that had been floating around since the 1970s. I think it's tied to a certain extent to the rise of evangelical Christianity. Also, the Church of Satan really had been founded in San Francisco in 1969, and its founder, Anton LaVey, was a real charismatic, very mediagenic kind of personality. The way that those allegations began to work their way into the daycare trials was first, there was kind of, as a corollary to the daycare trials, you have the phenomenon of recovered memory therapy happening at around the same time, in which psychotherapists working with adult patients would use hypnosis and large doses of very powerful drugs to get them to try to dig out memories of abuse from their childhood. And those memories sometimes turned out to be satanic.
How much do you think the backdrop of America's changing economy contributed to a sense of guilt here, in the sense that parents feel guilty about having to use daycare, and that the daycare centers were under a suspicion just because people didn't want to have to do that anymore with so many two-income households growing around the country?
Yeah, the economy plays a role. I think my argument is a little bit more shaded toward the social. I think that just the social and cultural status of the nuclear family had really begun to change in dramatic and permanent ways in the 1970s. You know, and some of the impetus for that was economic. Some of the impetus for it, a lot of it, was a result of the women's movement in the 70s. You had really unprecedented numbers of women entering the workforce, and you also had a skyrocketing divorce rate. So you would see these kind of anxious think pieces about, you know, what does it mean if I'm a woman and I take a job and have to leave my kid in daycare? You know, how's that going to affect his development? And these cases really just crystallized and dramatized all of those fears in the worst possible way.
How did therapists change their view of what they were doing because of this case? Really just rethink the entire field that had spawned all of these trials?
Well, professional psychiatry was one of the fields where you really did see reform in the wake of these cases, you know, which I don't think you saw much of in law enforcement or in the judiciary. But therapists, the thing they did in interviews with children was they came up with pretty good protocols for separating out or distinguishing forensic interviews from therapeutic interviews. So, right, a forensic interview is an interview where you just need to find out exactly what happened, whereas a therapeutic interview is there so you can look out for the emotional well-being of the child. And there are many instances in therapeutic interviews where maybe you prioritize some emotional component of what's going on over the literal truth of what happened. So those are much more separated now.
I mean, this is a broad question, but there's really no other way to ask it. As a result of your investigation, how many lives were just ruined from this case, from these accusations, from the prosecutions, the malpractice, the back and forth? How many people just really couldn't ever recover their reputations or their former way of life?
I mean, you know, it depends what you mean by ruined, but 80 or 90 people were sent to prison, were convicted as a result of these cases. Nearly 200 were formally charged with crimes as a result of these cases. And in almost all of the cases I looked at, the legal bills associated with that are really astounding. You also had a lot of children who were thought to have been victims at these daycares who were taken away from their parents. There was a case outside of Minneapolis in which one boy, you know, his parents were accused of running a sex ring, essentially. He was removed from home, kept separate from and completely out of contact with his parents for, I think, a year and a half. After that year and a half, then he began to fabricate allegations. And he said in an interview later, "Look, I figured I was never going home. I thought this was going to be how my life was forever, so that I might as well make it a little easier on myself and tell them what they wanted to hear."
Richard Beck, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Richard Beck is an editor at N Plus One and the author of We Believe the Children, A Moral Panic in the 1980s.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.